Hello and welcome to You Don't Know Lit. I'm Nick Argyris, and today I'm looking for a book with talking animals. To help me are my friends Ian and Joe, two English teachers.
My name's Joe Holshue. My name's Joe Holshue. I'm a high school English teacher, and Nick, if you're looking for a book with talking animals, I think you should read Charlotte's Web by E.B. White. It is amazing. It is radiant. It is humble. It is some pig.
Don't yell at me like that.
I'm Dr. Ian DeYoung. I'm a high school English teacher. And Nick, if you're looking for a book with talking animals, I think you should read The Wind in the Willows by Kenneth Graham, because Billy Pilgrim has come unstuck in time.
May your earlobes turn into assholes and shit on your shoulders.
Hey, the plot doesn't fucking matter at all. This is what I think it's about.
If you look closely enough, every author was at some point a racist.
Audiobooks don't count, right?
All art is quite useless.
Who told you that?
Fun fact, that is how Joe laughs.
What do you call it? Like, I was talking about this with Ulysses, but the sound in the pit before the actual
tuning
symphony.
Up. You're tuning up.
Yeah, you're tuning up. Just a little taste of what's to come.
That's what it sounds like.
No? Okay. What if we did a podcast that was just humming?
Ooh.
I have the voice for it. I don't know about you guys, but I have the voice for it. Definitely.
I do not.
I heard about a new type of tenor. So there's like five or six different types of tenors, you know? I don't know.
Seems a few too many, but go ahead.
Yeah, there's quite a few. Maybe there's less than that. Maybe there's like three or four. But there's a guy who was like the highest level of tenor, and he just kind of sings like this all the time. And he can hit the highest notes in the world. It's pretty interesting.
Listen,
if you're interested in high singing voices.
I used to be in choirs. I used to do choral singing. And I'm probably going to alienate our legions of tenor listeners, but
that's a good cut. It's fine.
Many tenors are the worst. I really tell you. Like, baritones are fine. Basses are fine. Some tenors are okay, but most tenors are just the worst.
What do you think it is? Is it genetic? Is it
like their worstness? I think it's it's that
nature or nurture. Like,
tenor. Mm. Well, so tenor is a beautiful range. And it has a lot of opportunities to show off. And I think it goes to their heads. I think they know. I think they know their voices are beautiful. And they think that makes them innately better than the rest of us. And I just don't like that.
So tenors might be born tenors. But it's the nurturing of being a tenor that makes them horrible. Right? They're born with the voice, but they are conditioned to be terrible people.
Yes. Right.
I think we can all agree that tenors are the absolute worst.
Yes.
Nick, how about you weigh in with your expertise on this, please?
Well, I think if any tenor should just stop listening right now. They can all go to hell.
I think this is the first definitive thing we've said on this podcast, right?
Like, strong positions on vocal ranges.
Let's start drawing some lines in this sandbox.
We should start making notes about what segment of the audience we'd like to totally ostracize next week.
Funny for us, not for them. All right. So we forgot to talk about whatever theme we're going to do this week. So you both kind of just simultaneously suggested talking animals as a theme, apparently.
It was a mutual strong arm. It was like that meme where there's like the two arms and they're like holding hands.
We really use that phrase a lot, strong arming. Maybe we got to come up with some new ones
eventually,
or something.
Yeah. It will be completely devoid of meaning. It will mean nothing whatsoever.
I think what you're looking for is arguing constantly.
No, we don't argue constantly. I would say
I disagree with what you're saying, Nick. We don't argue at all.
Okay. Maybe the podcast art should just be like a zoom in of those two hands clasped on that meme. I think maybe that's
like
what we should go for.
Like arm wrestling. Like,
like two strong arms. Yes.
Yeah. That would make sense. I think that would immediately read lit.
What if I adopt the nom de plume, or maybe nom de podcast, Arnold Schwarzenegger?
I like nom de podcast.
I like Arnold Schwarzenegger. Ian, what do you like?
I like it all. I like it all, baby. I said it, so of course I like it. Hey, let's talk about literature, guys. This is the part where I try and subtly make my way into going first. No, it's not. I want to talk just
Here
before we get started. I wanted to hear. Yeah, it's me. It's me, Arnold.
Ian Arnold Schwarzenegger.
I'm serious.
Who wants to go first? I think you guys should arm wrestle this.
I wanted to ask Joe about what changes sort of doing this podcast has done, has affected in your reading practice, your reading habits. Because I've noticed some interesting changes, and I wondered whether...
Seems like a natural segue.
Listen, when you're in the classroom, sometimes your students are just radically off track and you have to say, okay, we're going to do something else now. So
yes,
that's what I'm doing.
I have that experience. Yes. Yep, I have that experience as well.
I am so radically off track. All right, get us on track, Ian.
That's what I'm doing. Joe, how has recording this podcast, preparing for it, changed your reading practice, if at all?
Yeah, so if I bet you can...
Getting that live sound effect work there.
So Ian, I bet you can identify with this. Oh no. Oh no, no, no.
Is there any way we can mute Nick?
I think it might be more productive. So yeah, I bet you have this experience where my guess is like your entire life you've been a reader, right? I bet you were a reader when you were a kid. Like it probably never came particularly hard to you. And that was the same experience in my life. Like it's why we are English teachers today. But I bet also if you're anything like me, it's an easy thing to kind of fall by the wayside in your adult life, right? Like I still read. I always kind of have a book that I'm going through, but there's never any impulse to quickly move through that book. There's never there's never any stakes involved with that book.
What you're saying is that there's absolutely no purpose to reading.
Yeah, like other than enjoyment, right? Like
now
other
you've
than
given
like,
yourself a purpose.
But no, but like I didn't have a deadline. And one of the things I love about this podcast is like, I have to finish a book this week and I have to structure my life 7 days out in order for that to happen. Mm-hmm. And I think almost all of the changes that have come from that, maybe waking up a little earlier, maybe a little bit less TV, you know, maybe more reading instead of other time wasters, right? It's been fantastic, right? Like it has made me get through a book every week. And I mean, this is more reading than I've done in a long time.
May I jump in here?
Yeah.
Oh, I wish you would.
I have also dug my heels in because I don't feel like I need to read at all anymore. I get just the greatest hits. It's like I'm reading two books a week. Mm-hmm. And that makes me feel very good.
Makes me feel sad, what you're saying right now.
It's even better than reading book summaries or Spark Notes or something like that, because it's like two arguments for books that are specifically tailored for what Nick will like about them.
It's like somebody made a website with experts just for me.
Why didn't we call this show Pandering the Podcast?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
One of the other things that I...
Oh, we're still going on this.
We can stop.
This could be the full podcast episode. It's tough for me sometimes because I sit back and think, well, wow, these guys are bringing a lot of value to this podcast. And what am I doing? But just listening to you guys just drone on and on, like... Being your editor, holy shit, you guys need me so much. You need me so much. This could be a 6-hour podcast.
There is a lot of value in a good editor.
It's true. It's true.
Oh my goodness. Hey guys, why did you decide to pick books about talking animals, you weirdos?
I don't know. Did we have a concrete discussion about it, Joe?
You guys just dropped some LSD and you were like, yep, let's do this.
It is kind of a weird genre of literature, if you think about it, right? Like there are books for children. Both of us are talking about children's books this week, but there's also books for adults that prominently feature talking animals. And it's kind of this.
I think it's weird that the more you think about it, the more you realize how pervasive this genre is. So when we first suggested it, I was like, oh, well, Chronicles of Narnia, I guess.
Yeah.
But then we started talking about it. We started thinking about it more. And it's really strange how everyone does this at some point, it feels like. Mm-hmm. I never read any of them, but the Brian Jock Redwall books.
Oh, of course. Yes.
Are, as far as I'm given to understand, animals talk in them. So like it's hugely popular. You could depending on your definition of animal, you could say that Harry Potter involves talking animals. So
Well, and doing research for this week too, I was struck by the same thing. Like when I was trying to choose my book, how popular it is, but also how many of these books are classics, right? How many like books we look at and we say, "Yep, that is like absolutely this piece of classic lit that says something valuable about the human condition," entirely spoken by talking animals.
Yeah.
And I think it's this crazy thing.
Yeah, I hope we get into that, the sort of human-animal divide And how sort of animals are used to say things not so much about the natural world, but more about the human world.
Mm. No, yeah, well, let's get into it. Joe, you were completely robbed of a win last week, so why don't you go first this week?
So I chose Charlotte's Web this week. And Charlotte's Web, Nick, I'm guessing, is that a book that you are familiar with?
I've seen the cartoon.
Yeah, so Ian and I were talking offline before, and I couldn't remember if I had read this when I was young or if I had just seen the cartoon when I was young. And I had a hard time piecing them together in my mind. But Charlotte's Web, written in 1952 by a guy named E.B. White. And I think there's a couple interesting things about E.B. White. First of all, Nick, I bet you aren't familiar with this, but Ian.
How dare you? How dare you?
Immediately ostracize him.
I know everything about Elwin Brooks White and the American writer.
Here we go. You're going to say the thing about elements of style, aren't you?
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm going to say. Ian, what do you know about the elements of style?
Well, it was the bane of my college freshman writing experience because... It's a incredibly influential book that lays out how to write good. Basically, it's been through dozens of printings.
Dozens, absolutely. In fact, I was thinking when I was reading this and doing a little background. You know, E.B. White or Charlotte's Web is a book that I've always been familiar with.
I don't know what you guys just said.
Yeah, so I'm going to talk about it here because Charlotte's Web is a book I've always been familiar with. The elements of style is something I think, like you, I bought my freshman year of college because I think it's like just part of the starter kit for college, right? Yep. Like, Nick, you might own a copy of this book and not even know it. And I was thinking,
that's a scary
I wouldn't
thought.
Bank on it. I wouldn't
it's right behind you. Where do you think it is? Should I start looking?
He hid it somewhere in your house. You have 60 minutes to find it.
Somewhere in your house.
It will explode.
Book hunt.
I was thinking Charlotte's Web must be E.B. White's most famous book. And then I realized that it maybe isn't. It maybe is The Elements of Style. And The Elements of Style, Nick, it's by these guys called Strunk and White. And Strunk was E.B. White's, the writer of Charlotte's Web. He was his professor at one point. And together they collaborated. I think one served as the writer, one served as the editor. But it ended up being published as a combination of both of them. This book about what it means to write well. What does good writing actually mean? Stephen King has a pretty good book on writing called On Writing. But in it, he says that most books about writing are totally full of bullshit because most writers don't know what makes good writing. They can talk about it. They have some ideas.
Sounds like something any writer would say.
Especially a writer who's just written a book called On Writing.
On writing.
No. They don't know. I know.
I know.
So what does he say?
So he says that The Elements of Style is the only book on writing that has no bullshit in it. It is just straight up facts about good writing. And it's a really short book. It's about 85 pages, I guess, depending on the edition that you get.
So Joe, I guess I have a question.
Yes.
Where are the talking animals?
I guess I bring up The Elements of Style for two reasons. First of all, I think it's interesting that E.B. White can publish such successful, such classic books in two totally different genres. Right? Like his two most successful books are books about the actual mechanics of writing well, and then a book about a talking pig named Wilbur.
And it's so old too, and it's like coming up on 100. It was published in the 30s or 40s, I think.
Yeah, and it's full of this timeless advice about writing. I always remember, Ian and Nick, I always remember one of the rules about writing.
Yeah, do you have any advice? I'd like to hear some.
Yep, absolutely. And I think the most famous rule, and correct me if I'm wrong here, but when I think of The Elements of Style, I think of rule 17, which is omit needless words. Omit needless words. It's something that I tell my students all the time, right?
Because Ian, that you and I could take in this podcast.
Oh my God. That's going to be Nick's number one comeback. He's going to say, hey, guys, omit needless words.
So Joe, tell us about the book. What's it about?
Did White follow his own advice in writing this book?
Yep, it's like 3 pages. He gets right to the point.
Hello, it's me, E.B. White. The pig dies. The end.
Spoilers.
Snape kills Voldemort.
Bacon good. End of book.
The plot of this book is pretty simple to understand. There's a pig called Wilbur, and Wilbur is born the runt of his litter. The farmer who has Wilbur is going to kill
him. Slow down. Yep. Please slow down.
Yes.
All right. That's one more time. Walk us through it again. I am a little lost.
wait, what? Where did I lose you?
Jokes.
You're doing comedy. It's the Nick Argyris comedy hour.
Got it. Well, good stuff.
Really? Do you need me to start over again?
It's a joke.
I thought I was quite clear.
Hey, anyway.
So Wilbur's born the runt of the litter, and the farmer is going to kill him, right? The farmer is going outside to the barn with an axe because he knows that the runt of the litter.
You know, children's literature.
And with a chainsaw.
And his daughter stops him, right? He has a daughter who's probably like 11, 12 years old in here. And she stops him for obvious reasons. And the dad says, well, okay, if you raise this pig, if you raise the runt of the litter, we won't kill it, but you are entirely responsible for it. Wilbur is at first given this idyllic life. Like he lives in slop. They give him hay. He gets lots of good food. And he makes this friend named Charlotte. And Charlotte is a spider who happens to have her web in his pen, right in the corner of his pen. He finds out essentially he is being grown to be butchered for Christmas dinner. Right? Like that's what like the number one plot point in this is Wilbur mm-hmm. is alive, but Wilbur will be Christmas dinner. And this starts in spring, right? So Christmas dinner is a long way off, but Wilbur is understandably really concerned about this.
And he's a talking animal now. Does he have a working knowledge of what's going on?
So
did he see the axe coming? Is he aware, socially aware of what his fate?
So great question. He does not see the axe coming, right? Because he's just a baby at that point, and he's rescued, and he never has any idea. However, he does find out that he plans on that he's going to be Christmas dinner, and that does concern him. Like he is aware of that fate, and he does not like it.
Who wouldn't be?
So basically, what happens throughout Charlotte's web is Charlotte, his friend, the spider. She says, "You know what? I'm going to make it my job for you to not be eaten at Christmas dinner." And she does so very famously through a series of messages that she weaves into her web for people to see. So the most famous one is the first one that she weaves, which is above his pen at night. She weaves into her web the words, some pig. Like, this is some pig. And people start to gain interest in Wilbur. The farmer starts to think of him differently. And this is her way of trying to save him.
And she eventually writes, "That'll do, pig." Right? That's in this?
Yes. Pig. Yeah. So you're thinking of Babe, which is a movie about
a pig. I was just looking up
Babe.
It's so weird. Listening to you recap this, I've read this, but like, it feels like Babe's a bit of a knockoff.
Yeah. So really funny that you say that. I finished reading this book. I was sitting next to my wife this morning and I was finishing reading it. And I turned to her and I said, you know, I just realized as I kind of was reading through the last couple chapters, I just realized that I've been waiting for the phrase "that'll do, pig" to show up in this book. And I just realized that it's not this book.
What is Babe about?
Did you guys know that the George Miller, the Mad Max fellow, was involved with the film Babe?
Holy shit.
Well,
it's
two classics.
It's got a 97 on Rotten Tomatoes.
What, Babe does?
Maybe we should start a podcast about...
Movies with talking animals.
Babe is a great book, but I think Charlotte's Web is good too. So, you know.
Tell us about Charlotte's Web, the movie. Okay, so why'd you pick this book, Joe?
So when I was looking at books about talking animals, I was kicking around a few, and actually my wife suggested it, where she said, hey, read Charlotte's Web. And the first thing I thought of is I teach a freshman English class. And in my freshman English class, students always have a choice book, right? They always have something that they're reading in their life that is not in the curriculum, right? They just have to read something they want to read. And the clientele of my freshman English class is it's normally students that don't particularly want to be in an English class. So as long as they have a book that they are liking and a book that they're digging, I never stop them. Right. If they're into a book, I'd never stop them. And last year, I had this student.
Give us his full name.
Gosh.
But he was reading Charlotte's Web. And it it struck me as a book that was a little juvenile to read, but he was just like a dude who was into sports and into girls, and this was the book he was reading. So I just let him. I didn't say anything about it. And one day we were reading in class, and he had just finished the book, right? He was sitting right in the front row, and he had just finished the book, and I was sitting up in the front of the room doing a little bit of work. And he called me over, and he said, "Mr. Holshue, have you ever read this book?" And he showed me Charlotte's Web, and I said, "Well, it's been a few years."
Yeah, but in third grade, you idiot.
Well, yeah, but I said, "Well, it's been a little while, but yeah, I've read this book." And he looked at me, and just total earnestness in his voice and on his face, he said, "This book is amazing." And I thought, holy shit, what a great recommendation for Charlotte's Web from this kid who doesn't care about English, who doesn't want to be in this class. He finishes this book and says, "This book is amazing."
Who hates his teacher.
Who has the worst teacher.
Worst teacher. Just condescending him at left or right.
So you chose this book because your student liked it.
I chose this book on the recommendation of a 14-year-old boy. Yeah, great. Like a 14-year-old boy who doesn't like
how
reading.
I lived my whole life, honestly.
So what did you get out of the book?
I think there's a tendency for us to think of children's literature as lesser, right? Like children's literature in a lot of ways, like we remember it as like fun and light, but we don't really think of it as like is particularly of literary merit. One of the things that sets this book apart is E.B. White, the guy who wrote it, he has literary chops. Like the guy is an impressive, impressive writer. There's a famous literary fight that I want to tell you about between two totally different writers. Have you heard the name?
Literary fight?
A literary fight.
Welcome to this week's episode of Literary Fights starring Joe Holshue.
literary fights.
Have you heard, Nick? Oh, I have you heard of Ernest Hemingway? I bet you have.
Jesus Christ.
Here, read this children's book. Have you ever heard of Ernest Hemingway?
Have you heard of books, Nick? I mean, guys, I know I don't read a lot, but I'm not.
Okay, so you've heard of Ernest Hemingway. You've read The Old Man and the Sea.
Yes.
Have you heard of William Faulkner?
Yeah, Billy Falky.
Billy Falky. Billy, you got Pilgrim. It. So William Faulkner and Ernest Hemingway were contemporaries. They were writing books at the same time. And they have, if you're familiar with either or with both, they have very different writing styles, right? William Faulkner, he writes these dense, thick tomes that can be hard to follow and figure out what's going on, right? He uses words that you've never heard of before. Ernest Hemingway is almost the exact opposite in the way that he tends to write books that are relatively short, simple language, and tends to write books that are easier, right, in quotes, easier in structure and easier in style, but also like of literary merit. At some point, somebody asked William Faulkner, the guy who wrote the tricky stuff, what he thought of Hemingway's latest book. And Faulkner scoffed, and he said, "Ernest Hemingway has never been known to use a word that might send a reader to a dictionary," right? And that was his response. And it was really kind of this jab at Hemingway, right? Like he's never used a word that would send a reader to a dictionary. And then, being the good reporter that this guy was, he went to Hemingway and he said, "Hey, this is what Faulkner just said about your book. What do you think about that?" And Hemingway has a great response, and he says, "Poor Faulkner. Does he really think that big emotions come from big words? He thinks I don't know the $10 words. I know them all, right? But there are older and simpler and better words, and those are the ones I use." It's the equivalent of like a literary bitch slap, right? Like poor Faulkner.
A what
he
slap?
A literary bitch slap, right?
Like, oh, okay. I thought you said dick slap.
Bleeped out in post, right? Yeah.
This is all being edited.
Oh, what? That story has to stay. I'll tell it again.
No, I mean for content. For bleeping out your foul mouth.
Joe is just going to keep telling that story over and over to the end of the podcast.
Joe, what argument would you give this book for somebody who's older than 14? Giving him a reason to maybe pick this book up again.
One of the things that I loved about this book, reading it this time through, is how a lot of the themes in this book are actually really somber. They're really sad. Like this book is very much about like the changing of the seasons and
it's
getting
about a
older.
Death sentence.
Yeah, and like one of the heaviest themes in this book is death. right? This entire book, like the death of Wilbur is hanging kind of in the balance through all of the drama that happens in this book. I don't even want to say adult themes because it's not meant for adults. Like this is a book with heavy themes meant for children written in a simple and beautiful way. And the way that E.B. White balances that is in a lot of cases, just totally stunning.
Which is so crazy because a lot of like children's media, I don't know. I feel like every time there is a moderately controversial piece of children's media, whether it's a children's book or a TV show or a movie that has some quote unquote darker themes, so what people like to call more adult themes, like, you know, death or loss or whatever it is, there's always this idea like, oh no, like our old children's literature didn't used to be like this. This is all this new cutting edge stuff. It's so grim and dark. But like you mentioned the axe, and one of the things that stands out to me about this book is the image of what's her name? The little girl?
Fern.
Yeah. Fern hanging on the axe as he's going to like chop the pig. And like this is
Here's Wilbur.
This is like a, when you think about it in a sort of a dispassionate way, this is incredibly dark for 1952. Like this
I have another axe joke if you guys want it.
Please.
Yep.
And my axe.
Okay.
Oh, good joke.
Okay, I'll let you know if I come up with any others.
It's really interesting that this book is an example of how children's lit has always been hardcore. Like there is children's lit has not always been, you know, nice and fun, and modern children's lit is now dark. It's always been dealing with these questions, these issues, these concerns.
Well, yeah, it's why Looney Tunes is interesting for kids and adults. So, Joe, I still don't have like a good sense of what this book is like happening. What's happening in this book? So you mentioned the theme of like death. That's really exciting and fun. like walk us through. I mean, you know, you don't have to give anything away, but like what's the sense of this book? Like what's the general story? Like what other messages is she writing? What happens?
As Charlotte tries to save Wilbur, her plan is to write these things in her web that really make Wilbur seem like an exceptional pig, right? They make him seem different, like a pig that you wouldn't want to slaughter come Christmas because he's just such a cool, impressive pig. Over the course of the summer, she leaves these messages in her web, and she ends up leaving four by the end. Her first one is That's some it? Pig. Yeah, four. That's it. Four. It's These are hard book. For her to do.
It's a short book, man.
It's a short book.
Okay.
So the first one, she says some pig. Right? And it gains a little bit of notice.
Really follows Rule 17, doesn't it?
It really does. I mean, yeah, omit needless words. Some
four
pig.
Is enough. You might think maybe one a chapter. No, four is fine.
The second one she says is amazing. And when people see this message, right, Wilbur has this moment where he tries to act amazing, right? Like where he tries to embody amazingness.
And so all the people are reading these messages, right?
Yes.
Like everybody's reading them.
Oh, and it becomes a sensation, right? Like people start like the pastor in the local town, like talks about how this is like this divine sign. People start like showing up and seeing the pig, right? Like he makes the newspaper.
A spectacle, right?
A total spectacle, right? And
why do people start seeing the pig though? I'm not getting this connection. They're seeing a spider web with words in it, and they're thinking, "Oh my God, look at this spider web! Obviously, it's talking about the pig." Like I don't understand.
This, Nick, because one of the sections in my notes that I have that I thought you would like is I think one of the interesting things, and this is a little tangential about this book, is the power of advertising. Uh-huh. Because one of the things that happens is Wilbur is, he's a totally fine pig and he's very likable as a character. He's very innocent. He's very sweet. But he is not any of these things until Charlotte says he is these things, right? Yeah. So when she says he's amazing, he tries to be amazing. When she says he's radiant later on, which is a word that she gets off of a laundry box that the rat that lives there brought her. When she says
this
he's
is probably
radiant,
a good time to stop and thank our sponsors, our detergent sponsors.
Tide, brought to you by Tide. That radiant Tide. Shine. Mm-hmm. But when she says he's radiant, he tries to behave radiantly. Like he sits with his chest out a little bit. He tries to like sit in the sun so he glows, right? He tries to like embody radiance. And one of the things that I thought you would like in this power of advertising is even though Charlotte is the one spinning this in the web, nobody ever thinks, wow, what a cool spider. Like, that never comes up. Like, wow, what a cool spider.
This is relatable for you, Nick, because no one ever thinks.
And what I have in my notes is Wilbur gets all of this recognition and Charlotte does all of the work. Right?
What, life's a bitch, isn't it? And then they end up eating Charlotte for Christmas. It sucks. It's such a shame.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't there a moment where the farm, like, they've realized how important this is, and so they kind of get in on the action of helping Wilbur look, you know, amazing or radiant or whatever?
So the exact same, exactly. This becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. So when they're going to bring him to the fair, right, and he's been billed as this radiant pig because they, of course, have to show him at the fair because he's like Zuckerman's, the family name, famous pig.
Mark Zuckerberg's famous pig. Yeah.
The family comes out and they give him a milk bath, right? They give him a bath in buttermilk and they like clean him all up and he gets like this shine, this white shine from the buttermilk. And he really does appear radiant, like this shining beam of white light in the sun.
There seemed to be a plethora of talking animal books which focus on pigs. So there's Babe, and there's also Animal Farm, and there's this.
Yep.
I noticed that there's, in these pig books, there is a moment where human beings get freaked out by animals, for lack of a better word, animals' humanity. Okay. So animals are doing things which are human things. And that
taxes,
there's a moment,
a car,
there's walking a moment, on two legs.
There's a moment when the humans always are like, what the heck is going on? So I wonder if, like, you have any reflections on maybe first why there are so many pig books, talking pig books. And
you could tell us, that would be great.
And just also, like, what's going on with this fear of humanity?
Yeah. So I don't have any answers for you about talking pig books. My only thought would be that...
Why do talking animal books exist?
My only thought would be is that the pigs, anybody who spent time around pigs, and it's often cited by vegetarians, right? Like, pigs are incredibly intelligent animals, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So I think, like, if you've spent time around pigs, you think of them as, you know, you stop thinking of them as something like, you know, a cow or a chicken, which, you know, there's nothing behind the eyes of a chicken, right? There's no light there. But a pig does have this intelligence behind its eyes. And I think maybe that's where the idea of talking pigs comes from, or why it's so prominent. Pigs are also...
And Joe grew up on a farm, so that is... fact.
That's true.
Everything he just said is an absolute fact.
That's true. Pigs are also, you know, to quote Samuel L. Jackson, pigs are also charismatic, right?
Wait, I'm sorry. What Samuel Jackson quote is that?
I'm trying to, in Pulp Fiction, right? Don't they talk about...
When he has a tasty burger?
Yeah, when he has a tasty burger, no. But they're talking about a pig, something... I know they say a dog has charisma, and then Samuel L. Jackson says he doesn't eat dog either. I think Samuel L. Jackson doesn't eat pork, because the pigs have charisma.
Eat dog.
We're both Googling it. Who will Google faster?
Why you shouldn't eat dog. Not even once. Here, let me...
Pigs are filthy animals, says Samuel L. Jackson.
I don't eat filthy animals, right? Yeah.
That's so this actually goes directly against what you're saying.
Yeah, okay. Maybe cut this out.
No.
Hey, Nick, can you cut out everything that doesn't support my argument, please?
Yeah, so
make
no,
me
I
sound smart.
No, I ain't Jewish. I just don't eat dig on swine. Pigs are filthy animals.
That's right.
But bacon
dig
tastes
on
good.
Swine. It's just really interesting that there is this cluster of novels which is focused. I just looked up Animal Farm, and Animal Farm is actually published before.
Oh, interesting.
Before it was published 7 years before Charlotte's Web. So
yeah, maybe E.B. White didn't like this. He didn't like this anti-pig propaganda.
Like, I'll write a better pig book.
You know what's crazy to me? So this book you said was written in like the 50s.
52.
I just looked up when Babe was written. Babe, the movie was whatever, much later, but it was based off a book which was written in the 80s.
Wow.
And that just means like about 20 years later, give or take, the guy's like, yeah, I'm going to do another book about a talking pig.
I think
another
talking pig.
Which I just think is so bold. How about another?
And Babe, the novel, we're probably looking at the same Wikipedia article. It was well received,
per usual.
It got a lot of positive press. So I guess maybe this is just a deep well of pig books.
Pig books.
Yeah, I do think there's
next
something
week,
to it.
Bring me your best.
Oh, no. Well, there's two.
Oh, shit. So, Joe, this is a fiction book or nonfiction?
This is fiction. This is fiction so far.
We really should be clarifying that at the outset.
Yeah, please clarify that in the upfront.
What if our listeners are lost? What did you like about this book as an adult? So, like, as a child, you were probably not like, you know what? This prose is so taut.
Right.
It follows Rule 17. Like, you're probably like, cool story. I wonder if the pig will die. But now, as an adult reading this, you know that what's going to happen, whether or not the pig dies. So, like, what did you enjoy about it as an adult, and how did that differ from childhood reading of it?
Yeah, so I think when I read I think the things that are, like, powerful about this book are the same for adults and children. And I could imagine, I think this is, like, the perfect book to read to a child, like, at bedtime. For example, because I think it's engaging. It raises kind of difficult questions, but also deals with them in a very matter of fact way. You know, like when we're talking about death, right? Like death is a huge thing in this book, a huge theme that comes up in this book. But the way that they deal with death on the farm is the way that farmers have dealt with death for forever, right? Which is this incredible pragmatic practical relationship with it, right? Like death is not seen as a tragedy. Death is seen as just another stage of life. And like,
Joe, you grew up on a farm. Why don't you explain how you cold-hearted bastards fucking live on a farm?
And so I did grow up on a farm. And what I always think of is, and this is going to get dark for just a second, but farmers, retired farmers, old farmers have an exceptionally high suicide rate, right?
Whoa,
but But it's a high suicide rate late in life, right? Like
I know where this is going.
Yeah. So when a farmer gets old, right? Like when a farmer gets old, it is not uncommon for that farmer to kill themselves. And I think, like, we of course look at that as horrific, but I think there's something, and this is going to sound terrible, but I think there's something incredibly pragmatic in it where, like, if you're a farmer, if you have been like in animal husbandry your entire life, you have built your life around understanding when something has outlived its usefulness. Right. And when something has outlived its usefulness, it goes to the butcher, right? Like you kill it when it gets done. And I think farmers, they have had that relationship their entire life that is totally ingrained in them. And I think they look at this, they understand when they have outlived their usefulness. They understand when they have become a burden on those around them, and they do the pragmatic thing. You know, we look at that through a modern lens and we think, Jesus, that's dark. But I also think there's something about it that's like kind of sweet and kind of practical and kind of nice. And that's such it's such a sick thing to say, but I do think that like that pragmatism comes from a place of love, a place of love and a place of practicality.
I don't know where you're going with that at all. But I guess interesting.
That could be our tagline for our
show. I don't know where you're going with that.
But interesting, I guess.
Interesting, I guess. Should we talk? Do you need to talk?
No. I think like one of the things I'm struck by when I read this book, and maybe it's because of my background on the farm, but one of the things I'm struck by is the pragmatic relationship between life and death. They're going to kill Wilbur because he's meant for Christmas, right? Mm-hmm. And the reason they don't kill Wilbur is because Charlotte is able to make him essentially more marketable, right? Like he's more valuable to them alive than dead. And Wilbur gets this stay of execution, right? Like Wilbur-
Put some paint on that barn.
Yeah, like, Wilbur then like lives out his life.
So what's the moral of the story? Marketing is important?
I don't know that there's a heavy-handed moral other than to say that like this idea of like aging and death and like the seasons moving is okay. And it's just part of life. And it's a very,
I mean, are you reaching here a little bit? I mean, are those actual themes in this book?
Oh no,
100%. Heck yeah, dude. Yes, I agree.
I think I'm constrained here by the fact that you don't want to hear a spoiler, but I think like for this really to hit home, like I'm going to tell you the end of this book and that's all there is to it. Right. And you gotta edit it out if you want to, but like, I think that's where this really comes to a head.
Okay.
So at the fair, right? After Charlotte, like she knows she's dying, she knows she's fading, and she knows that her last job is to lay her eggs for the next season. Charlotte dies here. Wilbur's like going back in the crate, and it's the last day of the fair. And it says, but as he was being shoved into the crate, he looked up at Charlotte and he gave her a wink. She knew that he was saying goodbye in the only way that he could. And she knew that her children were safe. "Goodbye," she whispered, and then she summoned all of her strength and waved one of her front legs at him. She never moved again. The next day, as the Ferris wheel was being taken apart and the racehorses were being loaded into the vans and the entertainers were packing up their belongings and driving away in their trailers, Charlotte died. The fairgrounds were soon deserted, the sheds and buildings were empty and forlorn. The infield was littered with bottles and trash. Nobody of the hundreds of people that had visited the fair knew that a gray spider had played the most important part of all. No one was with her when she died. It's this really somber moment. Like, Charlotte doesn't just die, but she dies alone, right? But she dies having accomplished what she wanted to accomplish. Like, she has saved Wilbur by the time she dies. And in the next chapter, very shortly after, Wilbur takes it upon himself to protect her egg sac. He brings it back to the barn. He, like, gets it safely there. He, like, nestles it and keeps it warm in the winter. And the next spring, we get this renewal of life when all of Charlotte's babies hatch and they meet Wilbur. And Wilbur really has had this tremendous transformation from this thing that was being taken care of, right, to this thing that is nurturing. So when I say it, like, the touching things about this book are like the moving of the seasons and aging and death and renewal. No, I'm not making that up. Like, I think that is like absolutely what's at the center of this book and absolutely what makes this book beautiful. Like that 14-year-old boy in my classroom, right? Like, I finished reading this book this morning and I turned to my wife and I said, "Hey, this book is amazing. Like, this book is absolute. I'm so happy I read it again."
Hey, everybody. We forgot to record a teaser for next week, but join us. We are doing Back to School Month. So Joe and Ian are doing some of their books that they teach every year. So we'll still be picking themes every week, but it'll be all the books that they teach to their class. So tune in. Ian, tell us about your book.
All right.
Thank you, Joe.
Thank you,
good
Joe.
Work.
Solid
thank
work. I chose a book which is commonly called children's literature, but I don't think I resist that. I think that's kind of a limiting claim to put on this book, The Wind in the Willows by Kenneth Graham. I think it's more than that, and I'll share some reasons why over the course of this time. Kenneth Graham was kind of an erstwhile author. He didn't write very much. He only wrote a few books. The book was published in 1908 in England, and later in the U.S. he was an English author. And it's weird to me, just a little sidebar, it's weird to me that so many of these talking animal books are written by English people about England. Watership Down, Animal Farm, Babe, Chronicles of Narnia. I think maybe Charlotte's Web is a bit of an outlier because it's an American talking animal book. So initially, publishers turned this book down because it was too different from the author's other books. Reviewers hated it, but it was extremely popular, international popularity. Teddy Roosevelt sent Graham a letter, and he said, quote, "I have read it and reread it and have come to accept the characters as old friends." A first edition of this book recently sold for $40,000 at auction. The first edition was not illustrated, but since then, subsequent editions are frequently illustrated by a variety of big name illustrators. And most interesting to me, perhaps, in terms of adaptation, in the 1990s, Terry Jones, who was a member of Monty Python, directed a film version of this, which starred, among other brilliant British actors, four of the six Pythons. Eric Idle, John Cleese, Terry Jones, and Michael Palin.
When you say film version of this, you mean with actors? Like as dumb as that sounds, like this is not animated.
Live action. Yes, it is live action.
Live action. Wow.
There is some costumery. There's a tradition in the sort of the visual, the performative adaptation of this book, to make the animal characters humans who have animal characteristics as opposed to animals. And I can talk about why I think that's kind of a cop out and kind of a bad interpretation, but this is
called The Wind in the Willows.
Yes.
The Monty Python.
Yes, it is.
Okay.
Yes.
I thought you were stating a fact about Ian's book.
Way back at the beginning of my long spiel.
You're just like, kind of, 1 second.
You're just processing the title.
This is really called The there. Wind in the Willows.
Ah! Oh, boy.
And Ian, which book are you reading?
It's called Animal Farm. No, so it's had a long and pretty storied history. In 2003, I think it was the BBC did a survey of British readers to ask them like which books do they come back to most, which are their favorite books, and the top books were obviously ones like Harry Potter and The Lord of the Rings, but this was number 16 on the list. Not so much best, like literary quality, but like the most popular, the ones that people love.
The greatest hits.
Yeah, the greatest hits. So it's had this long and storied history, and it's been very, very influential over the course of its more than 100 years since it's been written. So
so what's the book about?
I'm going to first introduce you to the characters, and then I'll tell you a brief synopsis of the story. So
fantastic.
We have four main animals. We have a mole. And none of these have like human names like Wilbur or what's the Templeton?
Babe.
Templeton. Hey, Babe. Good pull. Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah, there's no human names for reasons which I'll talk about in a minute. But you have the mole. The mole is sensible, loyal, and steady, though sometimes he's taken by these occasional flights of fancy. There is a water rat who is clever, kind, poetic, and impressionable, and also loves riding in boats. There's a badger. The badger is grounded, plain, kind, formidable, dangerous, and somewhat grouchy. And then sort of the scene stealer, the one that most people know the Wind in the Willows for, is Mr. Toad. And Mr. Toad is this just incredible character based off of Kenneth Graham's son. Proud, expansive, a great talker, very good-natured, kind of mercurial.
Does he play the flute?
You're thinking of Frog and Toad.
Damn. Is Frog and Toad different?
It is. Frog and Toad is different, and that's another huge formative.
Hey, spoilers, you're going to ruin the next Frog episode.
And Mr. Toad is also self-centered. So those are our characters, the mole, the water rat, the badger, and Mr. Toad. And we call him Mr. Toad.
Now I'm thinking about Frog and Toad together. Frog and Toad are friends. Oh, looks like it was a series.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Dude, there was a time when I would go to the library and that's all I would read. I would only check
out. Yeah, that's good shit. Why don't you guys bring one of these good books?
Bring your best Frog and Toad.
Bring your best Frog and Toad book. There's so many to choose from.
It might be kind of hilarious, though, because like, look, what a challenge, right? I have to argue that this book with like 18 pages is better than your book with 16.
They have a tandem bike they ride together.
Oh yeah, they do.
That's adorable.
Oh my god, they're flying a kite.
Wow,
these guys are best friends.
And if you like that friendship stuff, you're gonna,
or maybe they're more, I don't know,
you're gonna like what I have to tell you about this book, Wind in the Willows, which sort of lays the groundwork for some of that classic friendship stuff. In this story, the lives of these four animals, toad, badger, rat, and mole, are drawn together. They have experiences dramatic and experiences reflective, and there's this stirring martial climax where there's a big fight, which I don't really need to spoil because it doesn't really matter. That's not the point. It's not one of these stories where kind of like you're building towards like, will the pig live or win or die or Charlotte will... It's not like that. It's sort of more...
Would you tell the author that? This part doesn't matter at all.
No, I wouldn't. it's sort of more meandering, like a river. And the river is one of these motifs that runs, no pun intended, throughout the whole book. So Mole and Rat become friends. Rat introduces Mole to sort of like the wider world because Mole just lives underground. So the first part of the book is Rat showing Mole like what the world can be. Gradually they watch their friend Mr. Toad become addicted to motor car driving.
Oh,
and it's referred to throughout as a motor car, so I'll be using this term even though it's a little bit dated. Motor car. And this is 1908, right? So it's very, very early in this whole sort of automobile culture, but
they don't know what to call it yet.
Mr. Toad becomes addicted to motor car driving. They try to help him. He escapes from them as they try and
help
him.
What do you mean by addicted?
I mean, addicted, dude. This is like a...
Like he's got a problem?
Yes. Yes, he does. I'll get to that in a second. He does actually have a legitimate problem.
Wow.
He gets up to various hijinks. They try and have an intervention. He escapes from them and runs away. And they're like, well, He's gone.
There's an intervention.
The friendship between Mole and Rat and Mr. Badger kind of grows gradually. And then eventually Mr. Toad returns. And his home has been taken over by a group of stoats and weasels. And in the order of this universe, stoats and weasels are untrustworthy, dangerous, kind of common, and conniving.
Yeah.
They also have guns, which we can get
into. Wow, okay. I have a question.
Yes.
I have a statement.
Yep. This sounds like, it sounds like there should be a key for this. Like I feel like everything is supposed to represent something else. So like if you talk about Toad representing the gentry, right? And like these stoats and weasels, I feel like the stoats and weasels might represent like some nationality that they don't like or something along those lines. Like
I think what Joe is trying to say is that this is a kid's book and I'm having a really tough time following
it. is Mr. Toad addicted to drugs? Like, is that the idea? Is that what motor cars is? Is this a stand-in for
LSD?
Is this about opium? Is what I want to know.
I don't think that. I think you could say there is some class commentary. The stoats and weasels aren't really racialized, but they are kind of presented as like new money. So Mr. Toad is old money and he's got all the bad stuff that goes along with that. And the stoats and weasels are new money. But they're also like this book, every time you feel like there's going to be a moral, the book kind of just like shakes itself and says there's no moral here.
Just like, meanders away from it, right?
Yeah, it's like you think maybe it's kind of like the Lord of the Rings in this regard. Maybe you can get something out of it as far as a moral, but you don't have to. You don't really have to.
Yeah.
It's not a book that has to be, like you say, a key. I think you could impose sort of like an interpretive key, an interpretive heuristic on this and say like, oh, this maps to that and this maps to that. But these characters grow and change. These characters undergo kind of different experiences, which show them in different lights. So I really feel like to impose a key on it would diminish its sort of expansive potential.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So is this like an adventure or just is devoid of any like larger themes or morals like Joe's book?
It is an adventure because Mr. Toad, the story ends with Mr. Toad kind of getting through all of his stuff, growing as a person, I guess.
Frog.
growing as a toad.
Pay attention.
And retaking his home with the help of Mole and Rat and Badger. So he comes back and all the experiences that Mole and Rat and Badger have had while Toad's been away, then these make the four friends a cohesive group. And so together they're able to conquer the stoats and weasels and also kind of conquer their more negative impulses, their own negative impulses.
I don't have a good sense of like what is happening in this book. Like, is it a long book or is it like little mini adventures they're all going on?
It's a short book. It's just, just 12 short chapters. I would say the overall arc of the story is the growth of this friendship. We kind of have two strands. So we have the strand of Mole and Rat and Badger becoming closer friends and becoming like more dependent on each other and understanding each other. And then meanwhile, Mr. Toad is like wandering around the countryside, stealing cars and going to jail. and then he finally comes back and he's like, well, I'm back. Let's resume life as it is. Now, like, you can't. Your house has been taken over by stoats and weasels. And he's like, well, I'll go take it back. And he gets driven away because they shoot at him with their guns.
How little are these guns?
Oh, they're adorable.
This is a weird thing.
I bet they're adorable.
Tiny little guns.
Yeah, little triggers.
It's fantastical, but it's not focused on lore. So it's not like, well, now we're going to have a chapter about what kind of animals they are that make guns and where they make the guns and all this stuff.
You're put inside this world. Like, you're put inside this world and left to figure it out.
They have guns. Right. Who cares? The toad can drive a car. It's all good.
I'm not very compelled to like understand why this book is worth reading. So like, why is this like ingrained? Is this like a British thing? Is this, you have to be from the UK to get this? Like, I don't get it. Why is this like such a greatest hit over the pond?
Part of it is that the river is not named, but the river is kind of like supposed to be based on Kenneth Graham's experiences living near the Thames River.
Mm.
So for Brits, there's a very much a sense of familiarity with that. But I think more than that. So like one of the things I really like about this book is that the animals in this book are animals. So sometimes animals can kind of be in talking animal books become these representations of humans. Do you guys know the word anthropomorphize?
I do.
Okay, Nick?
Yes. I think we all know.
I think Nick must sit here and he's like, do these guys think I'm an idiot? Like, I hate these questions.
Okay, so as we all know, anthropomorphize means to make more like a human. So a lot of books do this. They anthropomorphize animals, so that there's nothing really animal left about them. They make decisions in the way that a human would make decisions. They think about things in the way that their emotions are human emotions. So I think what Kenneth Graham does in Wind in the Willows is keeps this from happening across the board. These animals are presented as instinctual non-human creatures who retain the mindsets that animals must have. So you can believe, like, if you've ever seen a badger in the world, if you've ever experienced like badger life, badgers are like these, they have these sharp teeth and they're stocky. And you can easily believe that a badger would be suspicious and grouchy. And if a badger could talk, it probably would not use fancy words. And it would like common, simple food. And it would be a loner. You can easily imagine that a toad would be self-important. Just kind of the way
Why would I want to imagine? Where's this going? Why would I want to imagine that these creatures have emotions and feelings?
Parabolic. It has parable and elements of the parable to it. It allows us to see kind of these distillations of characteristics that we might imagine to be human, but are in fact more universal. We can't really say, like, you couldn't really draw a human character who is purely grouchy, suspicious, formidable, loner, common. But in making this into localizing all these characteristics in the badger, you can say, like, the badger is the apotheosis, the epitome of these characteristics. And it's less weird. It's less weird than if a human was this. Nick, you have been known to eat some food at various times in your life. Would you say
once or twice?
Is that true?
Shocking developments.
I don't want to take this podcast over, but it has known to be true.
Okay, so Nick, would you say that words, like, think about the best meal you've ever eaten. Can words describe that meal?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes.
Accurately.
Of course, good. I would use good. Delicious.
Fully. Completely.
Yum. Yummy.
He would use the oldest words in the English language.
I think what we're getting from Nick's
Rule 17, delicious.
That's responses. Right. Yum, 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 yum.
The more, you know, you don't need to convolute it. Good.
We have sensory experiences which exceed our ability to completely describe. You can say it was a good food. It was succulent. It was smelled really good. It smelled delicious. It was, you know, savory. But you can't sum it up. And one of the things that this book does really well is being evocative without being comprehensive, without being exhaustive. A quote, there's a ton of really great descriptions of food in this book, but it says, he got out the luncheon basket and packed a simple meal in which, remembering the stranger's origin and preferences, he took care to include a yard of long French bread, a sausage out of which the garlic sang, some cheese which lay down and cried, and a long-necked, straw-covered flask wherein lay bottled sunshine, shed and garnered on far southern slopes. And so this is a fairly simple meal, right? Bread, sausage, cheese, wine. But he describes it in such a way that you can, not quite, but almost imagine how it would taste.
I think it's so interesting that you and I both are talking about children's books this week. Or what? I'm sorry, I know you would say that.
No, that's fine.
Not,
it's all good.
But yeah, we're both talking about these books that are ostensibly for children. And here, one of the things that we both are taking away is, look at this language. Like, look at how beautiful the language is and how evocative the language is in our book, which is normally something that you would think, like, isn't that wasted on children? Right? Like, is it, you know, they don't have that appreciation for it. So we don't expect a child to appreciate it. So I think one question for both of us is, what's the point?
Well, they couldn't articulate the appreciation for it. So obviously you are super nostalgic about this book. Why should somebody else read it? Would it be good for somebody who's not British or not Ian DeYoung?
Absolutely. This book is full of reread potential. So you can read it and read it again and get more out of it the second time. It's absolutely well conceived. I mentioned before that Toad gets addicted to reckless driving. Eventually he steals a car, goes to jail, escapes from jail.
Jesus. What?
Yes. Yes. He gets addicted to driving motor cars. steals a car, goes to jail, escapes from jail, goes through a variety of troubles, almost gets back home, and then he sees a car in the road. And he freaks out, and he's like, oh, I'm addicted again. I'm hooked again. And so he's like, I'm going to hail them. And then he realizes it's the very same people that he stole the first car from.
Oh!
He was going to steal another car?
Oh, no, wait for
He's addicted.
They pick him up because they think he's like a... they think he fainted. They don't recognize him. They take him in the car with us. They take him in the car with them. He sits in the back, and he's like, hey, can I sit in the front? It might make me feel better. Like, sure. And they're like, and he's like, hey, can I help you steer? It might make me, might be
fun. Can I have the keys?
And they're like, and eventually he steals the car with them in it.
Oh my God. And he drives reckless endangerment.
He's now kidnapped four people.
The plot is absolutely riveting. And the final chapter,
riveting.
Well, yeah. Good. Yeah. The final chapter is, references the Odyssey. The chapter is called The Return of Ulysses. Here we go.
Uh-huh.
The
third week. It all comes back.
And Toad.
Let's just assume most of these books reference the Odyssey in some sort of story structure way. Just out of any book we ever review.
Absolutely. Toad has this triumphant victory, and it's actually really, it's well written without being sort of vulgar. How like they come in and they drive away the weasels and stoats, and they regain their proper place. This is a story a lot about where we call home and why we love our homes. And I haven't gotten to talk about that much, but like this is a huge part of it.
So what do people from the UK say about this book? You kind of mentioned it briefly, but what, like, how do they kind of describe this book and their kind of relation to it? Because I still go back to that thinking, like, I don't know, maybe you have to be from there, or like, what do they say? Do you know?
I know that it's been very popular. The BBC has done multiple radio and TV adaptations.
Seems ingrained.
It seems ingrained. Yeah, nostalgic, ingrained.
Absolutely. It seems like very much a part of this culture.
So I think we have a pretty clear winner today. And that is obviously the elements of style.
Yeah.
That far and away seems more interesting than either of the books that you've brought.
Very true.
But since we need a quote to end us, Ian, why don't you can tie us off?
To set up this quote, this is a bit of a longer one. And Mole has decided to go to the Wild Wood, which is where Mr. Badger lives. And he doesn't tell Rat before he leaves. And Rat has told him, we don't go to the Wild Wood, hasn't clarified why. And this is a passage which gripped me years, decades ago when I first heard it, and rereading in preparation for today's episode, it gripped me again. So here we go. There was nothing to alarm him at first entry. Twigs crackled under his feet. Logs tripped him. Funguses on stumps resembled caricatures and startled him for the moment by their likeness to something familiar and far away. But that was all fun and exciting. It led him on, and he penetrated to where the light was less, and trees crouched nearer and nearer, and holes made ugly mouths at him on either side. Everything was very still now. The dusk advanced on him steadily, rapidly, gathering in behind and before, and the light seemed to be draining away like flood water. Then the faces began. It was over his shoulder and indistinctly that he first thought he saw a face. A little evil wedge-shaped face looking out at him from a hole. When he turned and confronted it, the thing had vanished. He quickened his pace, telling himself cheerfully not to begin imagining things, or there would be simply no end to it. He passed another hole, and another, and then... Yes? No. Yes, certainly. A little narrow face with hard eyes had flashed up for an instant from a hole and was gone. He hesitated, braced himself up for an effort, and strode on, and suddenly... And as if it had been so all the time, every hole, far and near, and there were hundreds of them, seemed to possess its face, coming and going rapidly, all fixing on him glances of malice and hatred, all hard-eyed and evil and sharp. If only he could get away from the holes in the banks, he thought, there would be no more faces. He swung off the path
and plunged into the untrodden places of the wood. Then, the whistling began. Very faint and shrill it was, far behind him when he first heard it, but somehow it made him hurry forward. Then, still very faint and shrill, it sounded far ahead of him, and made him hesitate and want to go back. As he halted in indecision, it broke out on either side, and seemed to be caught up and passed on throughout the whole length of the wood to its farthest limit. They were up, and alert, and ready, evidently, whoever they were, and he was alone, and unarmed, and far from any help. And the night was closing in. Then the pattering began. He thought it was only falling leaves at first, so slight and delicate was the sound of it. Then as it grew, it took a regular rhythm, and he knew it for nothing else but the pat, pat, pat of little feet still a very long way off. Was it in front or behind? It seemed to be first one and then the other. Then both it grew and multiplied, till from every quarter, as he listened anxiously, leaning this way and that, it seemed to be closing in on him. As he stood still to hearken, a rabbit came running hard towards him through the trees. He waited, expecting it to slacken pace or to swerve from him into a different course. Instead, the animal almost brushed him as it dashed past, his face set and hard, his eyes staring. "Get out of this, you fool! Get out!" the mole heard him mutter as he swung round a stump and disappeared down a friendly burrow. The pattering increased, till it sounded like sudden hail on the dry leaf carpet spread around him. The whole wood seemed running now, running hard, hunting, chasing, closing in round something or somebody. In panic, he began to run too, aimlessly, he knew not whither. He ran up against things, he fell over things and into things, he darted under things and dodged round things, and at last he took refuge in the deep, dark hollow of an old beech tree, which offered shelter, concealment, perhaps even safety, but who could tell? Anyway, he was too tired to run any further, and could only snuggle down into the dry leaves which had drifted into the hollow, and hope he was safe for a time. And as he lay there panting and trembling, and listening to the whistlings and the patterings outside, he knew it at last, in all its fullness, that dread thing which other little dwellers in field and hedgerow had encountered here, and known as their darkest moment, the thing which the rat had vainly tried to shield him from, the terror of the wild wood.